की जाए, जगन्नाथ पुरी धाम की जाए, गंगामय जमुना देवी की जाए, भक्ति देवी की जाए, तुलसी महारानी की जाए, समवेत भक्तवृंद की जाए, गौर प्रेमानंद. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Namah. Om Vishnu Padaya. Krishna Prastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swami Niti Namane Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Bhutani Nivasesa Sinivani Bhaskajari Sitamani Bandeham Sri Guru Sri Tapa Kamala Sri Guru and Vaishnavam Sta Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitam Sam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Padijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitam Sta Vanchakalpa Chubhusta Keep us in the view of Tapati Tanam Pavanevi of Vaishnava. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. August 4th, 2018, in Zagreb, Croatia, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 11, Lord Krishna's Entrance into Dwarka, Text 12. Sarvatu sarva vibhava
Sarvatu sarva vibhava
Punya vikshalatashramai
Punya vikshalatashramai
Udyano pavanaramar Vritta Padma Karashriyam.
Vritta Padma Karashriyam.
Please chant. Sarva. All. Vrittu. Seasons. Sarva. All. Vibhava. Opulences. Punya. Pious. Vriksha. Trees. Lata. Creepers. Ashramai. With hermitages. Ujjana, orchards, upavana, flower gardens, aramai,
pleasure gardens and beautiful parks,
vritta, surrounded by, padma akara, the birthplaces of lotuses or nice reservoirs of water, shriyam,
increasing the beauty.
Prabhupada's translation in purport. The city of Dwarkapuri was filled with the opulences of all seasons. There were hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, and reservoirs of water breeding lotus flowers all over. Purport. Perfection of human civilization is made possible by utilizing the gifts of nature in their own way. As we find herewith in the description of its opulence, Dwarka was surrounded by flower gardens and fruit orchards, along with reservoirs of water and growing lotuses. There is no mention of mills and factories supported by slaughterhouses, which are the necessary paraphernalia of the modern metropolis. The propensity to utilize nature's own gifts is still there, even in the heart of modern civilized men. The leaders of modern civilization select their own residential quarters in a place where there are such naturally beautiful gardens and reservoirs of water. But they leave the common men to reside in congested areas without parks and gardens. Herein, of course, we find a different description of the city of Dwarka. It is understood that the whole dhamma, or residential quarter, was surrounded by such gardens and parks with reservoirs of water where lotuses grew. It is understood that all the people, dependent on nature's gifts of fruits and flowers, without industrial enterprises promoting filthy huts and slums for residential quarters. Advancement of civilization is estimated not in the growth of mills and factories to deteriorate the finer instincts of the human being, but on developing the potent spiritual instincts of human beings and giving them a chance to go back to Godhead. Development of factories and mills is called ugra karma, or pungent activities, and such activities deteriorate the finer sentiments of the human being in society to form a dungeon of demons. We find herein the mention of pious trees, which produce seasonal flowers and fruits. The impious trees are useless jungles only, and they can only be used to supply fuels. In the modern civilization, such impious trees are planted on the sides of roads. Human energy should be properly utilized in developing the finer senses for spiritual understanding, in which lies the solution of life. Fruits, flowers, beautiful gardens, parks, and reservoirs of water, with ducks and swans playing in the midst of lotus flowers, and cows giving sufficient milk and butter, are essential for developing the finer tissues of the human body. As against this, the dungeons of mines, factories, and workshops develop demoniac propensities in the working class. The vested interests flourish at the cost of the working class, and consequently there are severe clashes between them in so many ways. The description of Dwarka Dham is the ideal of human civilization. Sarvartu sarva vibhava punya vriksha lata shamay ujjano pavana ramayar Ritta Padmakarashriya. The city of Dwarkapuri was filled with the opulences of all seasons. There were hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, and reservoirs of water breeding lotus flowers all over. So certainly we want individual happiness. Each of us would like to be happy individually. But we would also like to live in a society or community where people are happy. Right? How wonderful would it be if every day when we would check the news, it would just be about how people are happy, how people are healthy, how they're happy, how they're getting their necessities of life, and how they're attaining spiritual realization. Wouldn't that be lovely? Yeah? If the news was like 99% good, occasionally some difficulty here and there. So when Prabhupada wrote the first canto of the Bhagavatam, he was in India. This was written probably in the 1950s. At that time on the earth, these concepts were very radical. They were even considered socially subversive. So maybe you're old enough, but when I was young, the concept of having an ecologically balanced society was considered very backwards. You know, I grew up in an environment where modern technology and chemistry and industrialization were supposed to be the saviors of the world. There was an advertisement on television that would say, better living through chemistry. And that was actually the mood. I talk about this often, how, you know, I used to watch this TV show where people were traveling in outer space and the computer was making synthetic food. They didn't need a garden. And everyone thought, this was wonderful. If we could synthesize food without agriculture. And generally we think that industrialization, science and technology has saved the world. In fact, if we talk about having a society without industrialization, everybody becomes afraid. But what does that mean? Does that mean that we're going to have to give up all of our comforts of life and live in some kind of horrific way? So here we're looking at Prabhupada saying in the first sentence, utilizing the gifts of nature in their own way. And that's really the theme of this verse and purport, to live in harmony with nature. That living in harmony with God means living in harmony with nature. Living in harmony with God means living in harmony with nature. Can we achieve bhakti yoga even if we don't live in harmony with nature? The answer is yes. Bhakti is independent. We can preach in a modern city like Zagreb, and we can be taking advantage of the results of industrialization, the clothes that we wear. Prabhupada several times in this purport mentions mills, which are of course textile factories. So the clothing that we're wearing, almost, I'd say, probably everyone here, is maybe your shirt is not made in a mill, your kurta, but I think for the rest of us, the clothes we're wearing, and maybe your dhoti also, is made in an industrialized mill. The metals that we're using on the altar, in the kitchen, are made in dungeon-like, or mined from dungeon-like mines. The furniture, everything we have here, most of this anyway, is made in some kind of hellish factory. And so much of what we're using is being made in some horrible industrialized situation. And still each of us can attain Krishna Prema. It's not that attaining Krishna Prema and Bhakti Yoga in an industrialized, mechanized society that is working in opposition to nature is impossible. That's not true. There are people who think, even in our Krishna consciousness movement, that Bhakti Yoga is only possible if we are living fully in harmony with nature. That's not a fact. However, if we are Krishna conscious, we will want to live as far as possible in harmony with nature, because it's Krishna's nature. Dhyayesha Gunamaye Mama Maya Dhrajya. This is Krishna's nature. The earth is Krishna's wife, Bhumi Devi. So, if you are in harmony with your father, naturally you also want to be in harmony with your mother. This is natural. Your father will be pleased if you get along with your mother, and your mother will be pleased if you get along with your father. Even among materialistic people, they call nature Mother Nature. Right? This concept that nature is the mother. So we should work with nature in her own way. And what's interesting is if we work with nature in her own way, we will be happier. We will be more prosperous. We will not be less prosperous. This concept that prosperity comes from having a war with nature, from trying to conquer nature, from trying to have dominion over nature, basically to rape nature, is really fallacious. It's just not true. We don't see that human beings are happier or more prosperous. And here Srila Prabhupada speaking on a societal level. And again, when Prabhupada wrote this, these ideas were very radical. Now they've become much more mainstream, but at the time they were just amazing and like, wow, how can anybody be saying this? And Srila Prabhupada saying, what are you doing? The trees you're planting in your city don't give fruits and flowers. Your material prosperity is being done by subjecting the working class, the artisans of society, to hellish conditions where they're full of disease and darkness, as if they're in a dungeon run by demons, where the people in the field of resources, in the field of production, and in the field of government, they're exploiting the people in the field of artistry. They're simply exploiting and making them live, as Prabhupada says here, in filthy huts, without clean water, without parks, without natural beauty. When they go out in their mansions in the country, full of their own parks and fruit trees and natural beauty, having, you know, natural foods flown in from halfway across the world. And we see this everywhere. We see it in India. Please don't think, you know, I'm going to go to India and I'm going to find everything. No. You see this in India, you see it in like the UAE, you see it very badly in the United Arab Emirates. You see it in South Africa. I'm sure it's here also. You see it even in America. You know, I don't know of any place where you don't see it. I haven't been to any part of the world. See it in China. China's terrible. It's terrible. Where the artisans, the people in the field of artistry, who are the majority of the populace, they're being horribly, horribly exploited. They've lost their craft, they've lost their artistry, they've lost the pride in their work, they're working. And Prabhupada points about these mills. You know, the mills were the beginning of industrialization, for those of you who are students of history. Textile manufacturing was a home industry, it was a cottage industry. And you still see this, you know, if you go to Mayapur Dham, so especially across the Jalangi in Swarup Ganj, it's a weaving village. And you see it's just people's homes that the husband and wife are spinning and weaving cloth and then selling it. But by taking the textile manufacturing out of the home and into the mills, so first thing that happened was the women were pulled out of the home. You know, there are many devotees in the Hare Krishna movement who genuinely believe that in a Vedic society, women had no varna, which is obviously untrue by reading the Bhagavatam. The Bhagavatam speaks a lot about women in the varnas, how marriage was between people in the same varna. And Krishna explains varna is chaturvarna mayashristam guna karma vivagashah, which indicates that both men and women have different qualities and work. We can say, well, women were just supposed to serve their husbands. Yes, but their husbands had a varna, and their husband's varna was being done from the home. And therefore, a woman's service to the husband was not just cooking for him and cleaning the house, but working with him in his varna. And Prabhupada talks about an ideal family life is the woman is spinning and weaving, the husband is weaving, the children are weaving. Together they produce a cloth and they sell it. We find among the cowherds, the young gopis are bringing their milk products across the Yamuna to sell in Mathura. Of course, they don't make it there because Krishna stops them. But this concept that the women also had an occupation. So when industrialization created the mills, the first people who were forced to work out of the home were the women. And when the women were forced to work out of the home in order to contribute to the family and in order to engage in nirvana, the family started to fall apart. And you have this whole breakdown of society. You know, when the men started working out of the home, Chanika Pandit says, it's a happy man who doesn't have to leave home to go to work. So the mills and the factories sucked the adults out of the home. And not only the adults, it sucked the children out of the home. It used to be the children would learn the occupation of their parents. Even the children, when they went to school, most people didn't have to go to school for a very long time. First of all, formerly there were no printed books. How well did you have to learn to read when hardly anyone even had a book? You know, you had to learn basic academics, and then you learned what you needed for your career. And this was true at all levels of society. And pulling the men, women, and the children into the mills and factories put everyone, as Prabhupada says here, twice uses the word dungeon. Something dark and dank and unhealthy and meant to torture people. And the people were getting tortured in these mills and factories. The children were getting injured. And then we said, well, let's pull the children out with compulsory education until age 16 or whatever to save the children. But the family had been destroyed. Basically, that was the beginning of the destruction of family. So husband used to be, the man used to run the household also. So the husband was gone, wife was gone. And then the home became mechanized. Machine for washing dishes, machine for washing clothes, machine for washing this, machine for doing that. And then people didn't want to have children anymore, because how are you going to have children if you have to leave your home to work? Right? It's incompatible. What woman wants to have 6 children? That was the average number of children women had before industrialization. How are you going to have 6 children when you have to go out and work? It's no longer practical. And nowadays, in order to work, you have to get a higher and higher and higher and higher education. So you can't even think of a job until you're 24 or 25. Which means that both the men and women have passed their peak fertility. And then you start work at 24, 25, by, you know, you have to develop your career. Women are not having children now until 30 or 35. It's not so easy to have children. The children are not so healthy. They don't want to have very many children. The world's population is actually now in danger. There's not enough young people to support the old people. Marriages can't stay together anymore. There's no extended family. All of these things is the result of industrialization. You can trace all of them. The conflict between women's career and home, which led to the women's liberation movement, was a direct result of industrialization. Before industrialization, there was no need of a women's liberation movement because women could have career and family together. They didn't have to choose. The whole movement for birth control and abortion, that wasn't necessary when you could have your family and your career at home. You didn't have to limit the number of children in order to find some satisfying life in the world. And then people are working at work. You know, the man has an affair with some woman at work. The woman has an affair with some man at work. They don't see each other. They're not working together. There's so much stress on the family. They're both working, and then they come home, and they're tired, and they don't have any energy for each other. They don't have energy for the children. Nobody has any time to cook. I remember going to a grocery store a couple years ago, and I asked one of the people who worked there, where are the spices? And she said, what do you mean? I said, spices. And she takes me to the ketchup and the mustard. And I said, you don't cook, do you? No, I don't cook. So people are now becoming, 30 years old. They have their master's degree. And they don't know how to cook porridge. They don't know how to cook rice. They don't know how to cook pasta. Why do you speak of something else? So what are they doing? They're buying prepared foods made in these, again, hellish factories. The consciousness of the people there are being exploited. The food you see in the supermarket, the packaged food, because of the system of distribution networks, is 6 to 12 months old. That means it's being pumped full of chemicals to preserve it. And I've been in a home where people bought like 10 bags of bread because it was on sale. You know, if you make bread, after a couple days, it's not nice anymore. So if you're buying enough bread to last for 2 weeks, what are they putting in this bread? What kind of chemicals are you putting into your system? But people have to eat this food because they have to work away from home in these hellish jobs to take all their time and sap all their energy. And then people are getting sick with so many diseases. Not only physical diseases, mental diseases are just skyrocketing. There's so many mental diseases. People are taking so many psychotropic drugs that these psychotropic drugs are coming out in their urine and going into the water system. And they're changing the fish. You can study this. There are fish that are, ingesting these antidepressants, and they become so mellow that they just, let the big fish eat them. Oh, there's a big fish eating me. I have no more anxiety. This is actually happening. And all the birth control hormones are going into the water, and it's feminizing the fish. The male-female ratio now in the fish is becoming skewed. So many mental diseases. I mean, and just think, even this birth control where women are subjecting themselves to putting all these artificial hormones in their body for years and years and years, which cause all kinds of cancer. So is this a happy society? Is this a desirable society? Plus all this industrialization, we're polluting everything. When I grew up, you could drink the water from the tap. Nobody had bottled water. It didn't exist when I was young. I heard Bhakti Jiviswami saying, what's next? Oxygen canisters on your back? I've been to parts of the world where it's so polluted. Just going outside, you're risking your health. Breathing outside is like, three breaths is like a whole pack of cigarettes. I've been in such polluted places. You don't see the sky. Ever. The people don't know there's a sky. There's just like this haze of pollution. The water's polluted, the air is polluted, the land is polluted. So is that happiness? And sometimes devotees think that if it would be good if the world has misery, because then people in their misery will pray to God. But actually it would be better if the world was happy. But happy in the right way. So here, working with nature in its own way. Cooperating with nature as nature is. Here it's saying that in all seasons, so there were seasons. Nowadays we eat strawberries all year. That's very peculiar, actually. In the fourth canto, it says that the highest standard of deity worship is to offer to the Lord according to the season and locality. The highest standard is not flying in things from other parts of the world. And Ayurvedically, when you eat something that's grown locally and in season, you digest it very nicely. So in contrast to Renyakashipu, He would force the plants and vegetables and the trees to produce out of season. But here we see in Dwarka, they worked with the seasons. They ate according to the seasons, and there was beauty in all seasons. Every season has its own opulence and its own wonder and its own way of living. And we also have seasons in our own physiology. That's what the ashram part of Varna Ashram is about. It's about working with the natural seasons of the body. So when our body is a child, we naturally want to learn. We're very curious and we're very dependent. So in that physiological state, we become students and we learn simplicity and humility. When we attain puberty, naturally, we want to reproduce. We want a romantic sexual life. And we also naturally want to have some independence. We want to do something in the world. We're full of idealism. We're full of passion. We're full of desires to do something wonderful in the world. So that is when one should marry and have children and have a career and act within the world for the service of the Lord. And then the body starts to get old. The eyesight goes, the hair, right, the hearing, the teeth, the energy. And one starts thinking, you know, was life really worth it? Do I really want to run around changing the world? All these things I work for, are they really that important? One loses interest in sexual behavior. One loses interest in one's career. One loses interest in changing the world. So at that time, one should retire. One should travel to holy places. One should do austerities. One should accumulate wisdom. And as the body gets older, one starts thinking more and more about death. One should then voluntarily give away one's possessions, voluntarily die before dying, so that death itself becomes very easy and prepare for death. So this is working in harmony. Right? Nowadays we work out of harmony with our physiology. The students are engaged just in satisfying their senses and encouraging their consumerism. The companies try to engender brand loyalty in children when they're 2 and 3 years old. When people hit physical maturity, instead of being encouraged to get married, they're encouraged to have illicit relationships and to delay marriage as long as possible. Instead of being encouraged to have children, they're being encouraged to not have children. Instead of being encouraged to have a career in harmony with nature that gives to society and improves society, they're encouraged to have a career that just fulfills their own ambitions and their own desires, to just satisfy, you know, their own things. When detachment starts to seep in middle age, they're told, oh, now get a new partner, or a new kind of partner. Start your second career. And when death looms closer and closer, then people are encouraged to just sit around watching television and playing checkers and are wasting their time. So on an individual level, we're not working in harmony with our own physiology. On a societal level, we're not working in harmony with nature. If we do work in harmony with nature, both our own physiology, our own psychology, and with the world, and then we'll have a society full of natural beauty and natural opulence. So I see even in many of our temples, even when we have property in our temples, like I visit many temples where they're growing flowers, but then they buy flowers for the deities. I was recently in a temple like this. They had a huge garden, huge garden. The flowers in the garden were just dying on the plants. And you know, where they had this rose garden and the roses were dying on the plants, and they're ordering chrysanthemums. You know what is chrysanthemums? Mums, they're also called. They're really a winter flower. You know, they have kind of a weird smell. They're very cheap. And I'm thinking, why are they buying these chrysanthemums, which is, you have to use them in the winter, but why are they buying them in the summer when they have roses falling off the plants? I've been to temples where they have fruit trees on the property, and the fruits are falling down and rotting, and they're going and buying fruits from the market. Well, I go to temples where there's property and they don't do anything with it. They don't grow any flowers. They don't grow any fruits. householders who have land, again, they're not growing any flowers, they're not growing any fruit. They're just, you know, low maintenance. That we right? What did Prabhupada say? Impious trees. Now you see some examples of the opposite. You see some places where they do use these gifts of nature. I mean, one thing I see in Europe is in the European cities, people are much more likely to grow fruit trees and flower trees than I've seen in America. So where my son lives in America, they had to get permission from all of their neighbors and from the housing development before they could plant one fruit tree. Because the tree will grow over the wall between their house and the neighbor's house, and the neighbors will see it. So therefore, to grow one lemon tree. It's interesting, their lemon tree produces such huge lemons, like this big, you know, like as big as 1.5 tennis balls. It grows so many lemons that they don't even know what to do with all the lemon juice. But they said it's difficult to give the lemons to their friends, because when the friends see it, they say, what is that? You know, they're not used to these huge fruit. When I was in Hawaii, so there's so many avocados and so many kinds of avocados. They're growing wild all in the forest. One devotee friend of mine, before she became a devotee, she intentionally lived for 1 year without a home in Hawaii. Just climbing the coconut trees and the avocado trees and bathing in the sea. So when you go to the farmer's market, there's so many avocados all year and all different kinds. And I've never seen actually the Hass, which is the main kind you get in most of the world, but butter avocados, oh my goodness, all these avocados. People would visit us and they go, I never knew an avocado could taste like this. But when you go to the big supermarkets, they have the Hass avocados imported from Mexico, in Hawaii. Like, what are you doing? The avocado tree is growing outside your door, you know? Literally. There's one shop there that sells fruit juice. And if you order, you know, a pineapple, banana, mango shake, they literally walk outside and they pick the mango and the pineapple and the banana and make you drink. And they actually do that. When I saw that, when I went there first time, the devotee said, "Anyway, you have to see this place." And yet, even there in the big supermarkets, they're importing avocados from Mexico. But anyway, you do see in some parts of the world. When I was in Sao Paulo in Brazil, so lining the streets in the city, there were flowering trees. And when the trees would flower, the whole city was perfumed. It was amazing. When I was in Serbia, what's the capital?
Belgrade.
Belgrade, is that it? So there, they had fruit trees in the city, right in the city, on the side of the roads. I thought, this is what Prabhupada's talking about. So some places you still see that. You still see that they're planting flowering trees and fruit trees, you know, in public places. So the public can go to a park, the public can walk down the street, and you can just pick some fruit and you can smell the flowers. Not just in pious trees. So there's some idea of this still in the world. But this is how we should live. If we're thinking about a Krishna-conscious society, and I hope we're all thinking about a Krishna-conscious society, then we should try ourselves. How can I live in harmony with my biology and my psychology? Because these are also indicators from Krishna. I read a book recently about the damage being done to young people, especially young women, but men also, in the modern universities, with the advice that's being given, especially about sexual behavior. It was a very heavy book written by a doctor who works in a university. So she's a university doctor. And she was saying how that the students in the university are being given advice only about things which are against their biology, how to go against their biology. She said they're not taught basic biological facts that would help them in their health. And near the end of her book, she said, if your ideology is not in line with biology, then you should reconsider your ideology. And I thought that was very profound. We talk about, what does Krishna want? What is the will of God? What should I do? What should society do? And one of the keys to understanding that is to look at nature. How does nature work? How does my body work? How does my mind work? How is nature designed? If I want to know something about how to use this building, what is the will of the architect and the builder, I look at the design of the building. I don't take down a supporting wall in the building. Because I don't like this wall here. But if it's a supporting pillar, a supporting wall, you can't take it down. Your whole building will collapse. So we may say, well, does that mean we all have to become primitive? The answer is no, Dwarka isn't primitive. There's so much archaeological evidence that there were plumbing systems in ancient cities. Sariputta found evidence of robots. I mean, it's interesting, Prabhupada here talks about the dungeons of mines, but it's not that there wouldn't be mines. Of course, there'd have to be mines. They were using metal in Dwarka. It's not that nobody used metal and nobody used gems, but they were mines that didn't harm the earth. They weren't strip mining. They weren't mining that put people so far deep into the earth that the temperature was so hot that they could barely live. So it's not that there can't be development. It's not that there can't be production, and it's not that there can't be mining, and it's not that it can be all of these things. We don't have to live like, you know, some tribal people. It's not necessary. We could have an advanced civilization that is in harmony with nature. And that's what we need to do. At least in our own sphere of life. Whatever is our own sphere of life. To act as much in harmony with nature as possible. It's a very simple way to understand the will of God. It's very, very simple. You don't need a scripture for it. Any person can observe nature and understand something about how to please God and how to act in harmony with the will of God. So it's something we should examine in our life. Is there something we can do in this temple? Is there something I can do in my particular service? Is there something I can do in my family? Is there something I can do in my life to move closer to nature? We may not be able to do it in all areas without the support of a whole society. That just is what it is, what it is. This cup, I'm sure, was made in some hellish factory and mined in some dungeon of demons. What can I do? I can't create my own mind. But I can speak about it, I can teach about it, and as far as possible within our own lives. And when we do that, we will become happier. We'll become more peaceful. So questions, comments? Yes, Brian.
When I work with the people in my workshops, I find out that most of us are so disconnected from our nature, from our talents, from our dharma, from what is natural for us, that I found out that just to stop them and that they admit that they are disconnected, that they need to do something about it, it's like a revelation for most of the people, and they feel like, wow, it's possible, something like this.
Yes.
So my question is, how to connect, how to help people connect again, or how to help ourselves connect again with what you were saying, with our natural biological rhythm, with our natural talents, and it seems like I ask sometimes people, if you can have an opportunity to have a job where you will be paid some amount and you will do what you like, and then you have a job where you will be paid double but you do something you are not for, what will you choose? Most of the people now say, take the first opportunity. But in the beginning, they just say, I will work for some time in this second job, and when I get lots of money, then I will do what I need for. So, could you please tell us what to do at this point?
Even many devotees will say things like
that. Even devotees sometimes.
I think, you know, first of all, it's just explaining it on a theoretical basis. Because if you speak immediately on an individual basis, people resist you very strongly. So I think first speaking about it in a general, theoretical, philosophical way. That, and right now in the world, the concept of being in harmony with nature as a general principle is very acceptable. You know, it's just that we should be ecologically minded, that we should have some thought for how our actions are affecting the general ecology. This has become very popular. It wasn't popular 50 years ago, but it is popular now. And so to get people to agree with that, I don't think is terribly difficult, at least as a concept. And then if you take that concept down to the individual level, you know, again, in theory, I would do it that way. To start out with people's basic agreement that we'd be a lot happier if we could live in harmony, if we could, and to give the concept that we can be prosperous and comfortable and still live in harmony with nature. I mean, again, society in general is moving in that direction. One of the main powerhouses for our modern society is electricity. Basically, without electricity, our modern technological society is finished. But you can get electricity from natural, renewable, sustainable sources like wind and solar and water. So you can bring that up as an example. There are ways that we could continue to have a developed lifestyle in harmony with nature, that it's not, these two things are not in opposition. It's not that living in harmony with nature means you have to be, you know, you have to spend all day just to take care of your basic physical necessities. And that even then you don't do it very well. And once people can agree with that principle, which I believe most educated people will agree with that principle, that at least it's in theory it's true, and that we're working towards it as a global human society, which I believe we are. Some places more than others, but in general, yeah? Was this true?
Yeah.
Then in the world in general, human society is trying to aim for having a worldwide culture that is sustainable and regenerative with the earth, with the ecology, and at the same time gives us comforts and an advanced life. Yes? Would that be a factual statement?
In theory.
In theory. And there are many companies and many governments that are working towards it in practice on some level. Yes?
Yeah.
I doubt, in fact, that there's any country in the world that's not working toward this in any way. I don't think that's true. I think every government is doing at least something to move in this direction. And many businesses are dedicated to this direction entirely. So how long did that take to talk? 5 minutes. So what about on an individual level? So on an individual level, it may mean, you know, I buy biodegradable packaging. I buy naturally produced materials. I buy more handcrafted materials. I recycle. I have a fruit tree in my backyard. I grow some flowers. Are people going to agree with that? Yeah? Would most people agree with that? Even if they're not doing it, they would agree that that would be a beneficial thing for them. And if they knew how to do it simply and cheaply, they would do it. Then take the next step. Well, what about our body and mind? That's our own little planet that we're living on. It's our own little ecosystem. And just like, you know, we don't really want to damage the environment now and think I'm going to pay for it later. Well, let me pollute now because it's cheaper and I'll deal with it later. So in the same way, we don't want to do something that's polluting our mind and body now with the idea that, well, I'll deal with it later. because, you know, it's cheaper to do it that way. And then, well, yeah. But people are scared as to what that means. You know, what is the price that they have to pay for that? Another way you can talk about it, and we, Rukmini and I talk about this extensively in our book on Varna Dharma, is the six kinds of wealth. That to think of wealth just in terms of money is erroneous. We all want to be prosperous, but there are six ways of being prosperous. And each of us really enjoys certain ways of being prosperous more than others. So when we're talking about how much wealth we get from our work, we are definitely not just talking about money, which is one subset of Aishwarya. And in fact, really, money in and of itself only facilitates the six kinds of wealth. Money in itself is not wealth at all. It just isn't. Money has no value until you spend it. Yes?
Yeah.
I mean, it may be some psychological value that you feel some security that you can look at your bank account and you can say, I have 20,000, you know, kunas in the bank. And so, okay, I can be peaceful. But even that doesn't work because whatever system you have of saving your money, you know very well, can collapse because it's happened to people you know. And you know you could have some sort of emergency that required you to drain your savings because it's happened to people you know. So the only value that wealth has that's not being spent is some sort of mental security, a very shaky mental security. Why is money wealth? Because it facilitates you getting the six opulences. That's all. As I say, in and of itself, it's not wealth at all. So look at what kind of wealth do you want from your work. You want work that gives you the kind of wealth that you want, not just in terms of giving you money so you can purchase. And some kinds of wealth is hard to purchase with money also. So money is not compatible with so much again. I mean, you can gain an education with money, but you may not gain actually knowledge with your education may not give you knowledge. We've all had the experience of taking classes where only 10% of the class was actually valuable. Yeah? When I was working in a government school, the woman who worked in the office with me was also a student at the same university as I was. And she got something in the mail for professional development classes one weekend for $400. And she said, do you really think that it's worth it to take a weekend course for $400? And I said, well, you know, at the university we're going to, each 30-hour course is probably about that much money. I mean, I was getting it paid for in another way. I wasn't having to pay for it. But, you know, I said, if you had to pay for it, then the course would be about $400 or $500, then plus the $100 for the books and so many things. And I looked at her, I said, is it worth it? Are we getting that much value? And she was just really quiet. You know, the reality is in the 30 hours of instruction, there's probably about 3 or 4 hours of that that are actually valuable. Yeah? So my point is, with money, it's hard to buy gyan. You certainly can't buy vairagya. I mean, it's hard to buy yasha. You can't really buy yasha either. Sri, Virya, and Aishwarya, to a large extent, you can buy. Even those, you know, money is of limited value in getting the genuine prosperity that we want. I can buy things of beauty with money. I can buy beautiful furniture and beautiful paintings and, you know, beautiful plants to put in my garden and have a beautiful house, and I can buy beautiful clothes. But Shri also means a kind of splendor. It's kind of hard to, I mean, to some extent you can buy physical beauty with money. You can buy hair dye and makeup and, I guess, plastic surgery, if you want to take it that far. But Shri also refers to splendor. It refers, it's a very aristocratic kind of beauty. That kind of beauty cannot be bought. Virya is strength and health, vitality, sexual potency. So again, I mean, if you have money, you can buy a gym membership. You can buy healthier food. But really, strength comes from exercise, which you don't need a gym. You can just take a walk. And, you know, a healthy lifestyle and so forth. So although we all need money in order to have a basic shelter, and we all need money to have some basic food and clothing and these things, most of the wealth and prosperity we want to enjoy cannot be bought directly with money. It just can't be. Aishwarya, Prabhupada often translates as just wealth, but Aishwarya comes from the word Ishvara. The wealth of Aishwarya is the wealth of power, the wealth of leadership, the wealth of control. So, can you have more power and leadership if you have money? Well, yeah. But to be a real leader and the real pleasure of leadership, or yasha, I guess you can buy fame if you're very rich also, in a sense. But yasha means people talk about you because you're dharmic. So that's kind of hard to buy. And I think if we think about our prosperity very holistically, what does it mean to be rich? There are six kinds of rich, six ways to be rich. You can be rich in fame. That also applies to community. So let's look at them. Yasha, the wealth, the richness of yasha. People like you. And they like you because you do good things. They don't like you superficially. You're a good person. You're a righteous person. You have some high self-esteem because you actually do good things. And other people praise you. Yasha is the wealth of community. You have community, you have family, you have friends, you have a support system, people like you, they appreciate you, and you're doing things that are valuable and dharmic. That's a certain kind of richness that most of us want, more or less. Okay, we talked about the richness of Shri. The richness of Shri is splendor and beauty. Prabhupada's speaking a lot about that in today's verse and purport. So this is having an attractive place to live, inside and outside. Attractive in terms of the building, attractive in terms of the furniture, of the artwork, your clothing, your body, the surroundings. Then we have the richness of virya. So virya is health. To have a life that's rich in health, in vigor, in strength, mental strength, physical strength, particularly also sexual strength. Then you have so we've talked about which one so far? We talked about yasha, shri, and virya. So then there's the wealth of Aishwarya. The wealth of Aishwarya is the wealth of leadership and control on a basic level. It means you have some autonomy in your life. You have some control over your life, what you're going to do. You can decide what you're going to do, when, and how. You're not in a society or community where you're tightly under somebody else's control. You have some independence. It can also mean, as we said, leadership. The wealth of leadership. This is a wealth where you would have followers. You'd have people who work for you, people that you're inspiring. This is also having some power in society. Then there's a wealth of gyan. So this is, you know stuff. You know stuff about the world, you know stuff about your job, and you have wisdom. You have the ability to make good decisions. You can understand the way things work. You can understand how you work, how other people work. I was just reading how Krishna studied psychology in the Gurukula. Then you have the wealth of vairagya. So the wealth of vairagya, you have freedom. You can have the kind of job you want, you can marry who you want, you can live where you want. And you're satisfied and peaceful internally. So if something happens and you lose things in life, you're not so disturbed that you can't function. That you can function, you know how to function through the ups and downs of life. You're not so dependent on externals. You have an internal sense of balance and harmony that's not easily disturbed. You don't often become angry or lusty or greedy, or you have some control over your mind. You're not swept along by your emotions. So these are the six ways of being rich. Now, all of us would like all of these, but some of us would like some of them more than others. Some people are more into freedom than others. Some people are more into wisdom than others. Some people are more into beauty and splendor than others. And our career should give us a life that's rich in these ways, in a very holistic way. Just thinking about money is really, really actually kind of stupid. And there's so much, I mean, that's my specialty, is in job satisfaction. That's what I did my doctoral dissertation on. So study after study shows that if you have enough money to live comfortably, anything over that does not contribute to your happiness with your job. And in each country, there's a level of income over which your happiness in life isn't affected. That level is different in different countries, depending on what the standard of living is. So we all want enough money so that we don't have to worry, you know, will I have to live in a tent? Am I going to be hungry? I mean, if we don't have that much money, then we won't be satisfied with our work, even if it's according to our nature. But once you have that much money, the money doesn't matter. That's study after study after study after study after study. It doesn't matter. It doesn't add to job satisfaction or dissatisfaction. Sometimes money can add to job satisfaction if it's related to other things. Like if you get an increase in status that also comes with a higher paycheck. The money may symbolize your increase in status. Money can symbolize that you're valued by your work. Money can symbolize that you have more leadership and more power. So money can symbolize yasha. Money can symbolize aishvarya in a job. But what you're really enjoying is the yasha and the aishvarya. The money symbolizes that. I mean, like when my stepmother took my inheritance away from my, that I would have gotten from my father and even from my mother, it wasn't the not getting the money that was upsetting, but the money symbolized the affection of my parents. So that was kind of traumatic. You know, when Dhruva Maharaj was told, you can't sit on your father's lap, I mean, he wanted the kingdom, not so much because he wanted it was about affection. The kingdom was a symbol for affection and acceptance. So money is again, other than the basic necessities of life, money is really just a symbol or a stand-in for other things that we want. And if we have those things, we don't really care about money. If your life was rich in all of those ways without money, why would you care about money? The answer is you wouldn't. Isn't that true? If you can have everything you wanted to enjoy without having to have money, why? You can have money to have money. It doesn't have any meaning in and of itself. Money only has value when it's spent on something. It doesn't have value until it's spent on something. That doesn't mean you shouldn't save money. I'm not implying that. But it's what we spend it on that has the value. So I think all those ways can help people to understand that I'll be happier if I work in accord with my nature. And part of my nature is, how do I want to be rich? In which ways do I want to be rich? Which ways are most meaningful for me? And I should have a lifestyle and a career. You know, we generally look at the four fields, the fields of ideas, the fields of government, the fields of resources, the fields of artistry, in terms of career. But the six forms of wealth are also important. And you want to, certain fields of work, certain varnas, tend to produce certain forms of wealth. But all the forms of wealth are available in all of the varnas. So when looking at one's job, one wants to look at how does the type of wealth that I want to enjoy work with the type of field that I want to be in. You know, do I get happiness from playing with ideas? Do I get happiness from facilitating people getting everything they need and taking care of them? Do I get happiness from playing with natural resources and wealth and money? Do I get happiness from playing with beauty and function and being supportive and so on? But they go together. You don't want to just look at them separately. And then the last thing would be about time. Do you want to be happy now? First of all, the future is always uncertain. There may not be a future. If you work in a situation that you hate with the idea that you will enjoy later, guess what? There may not be a later. Life is very uncertain. Whatever age we are, somebody's died at it. You know, we may not live to get our dream job next week. All we have is the present. And if we're not being happy in the present, we're full. There is no such thing as tomorrow. It's always the present. The future is the most illusory of the three phases of time. In one sense, it never exists. It's never the future. So to sacrifice the present, which is real, for a future, which is always unreal, is a very key symptom of illusion. In the spiritual world, it's always the present. Again, that doesn't mean we don't save money. I'm not saying that. It doesn't mean we never plan for the future. You know, I have airplane tickets that I bought for the future. You know, it's not that we never use the present to plan for the future, but it's that while we're planning for the future in the present, we want to be happy in the present. Don't sacrifice present happiness for future happiness. I should always be happy now. Even if part of what I'm doing now is preparing for a future. And the way to be happy now is to be connected with Krishna now. There's no other way to be happy now. Is that all right? Yes.
We speak about harmony with nature, with our sadhana, perhaps. I think that this Varnashrama, this is basis of our spiritual life. This is my opinion. I'm a chemist engineer, biochemist engineer. I know very much about food production in factory, about agriculture, about food, about chemistry. But my conclusion when I was working in school, and then I, with my disciple, make workshop, ecology workshop. Yeah. After that, my conclusion was the only solution is to back to garden, and because of that, I was born in city in Zagreb, but I don't know nothing about gardening. But after step by step, I saw that is only that this is very compatible with praxis, bhakti yoga, this gardening. And when I today I have also garden, and I think this is very, very good. But My opinion is that Bhakta in our temple have to back to garden, because we have garden in the neighborhood in our temple. This is my opinion. And I don't have support in our society with this idea. I can help in this way. But there is no understanding in our at the moment about my idea. Sorry, but my English is not very good.
No, I could understand you.
You understand?
Yes, I think that for most of us, we have some personal experience and some personal realization of how we could move the society of devotees locally or internationally closer to Prabhupada's dream. And many times when we go to the leadership or the general devotees, they don't have that experience and that realization. And therefore we find a lack of support and frustration. And this has been true in my area of service with children's education, right through the line that so many statements from Prabhupada, you know, just doesn't seem to matter. And you just get very frustrated. But at the same time, I've also concluded that we can each do it at least on our own. If I can't affect the general society, at least I can do it myself. It's not very satisfying, but it's something. And at least talk about it with the devotees and put it out there. And eventually, who knows, maybe somebody will pick it up. And that's really all we can do.
Yeah,
I mean, one thing, you know, that happens when we get older is we realize, hey,
yes.
You know, I can't, I'm not the controller. You know, when we're young, we have all these ideas, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. This is going to happen, that's going to happen. I think as we get older, we become a little bit more humble about what kind of influence we can have and what kind of power that we have. But without bitterness, the main thing is not to become bitter or to become critical. That's the main thing. You know, take my realization, my understanding, implement it in my own life, be encouraging with others about it, but not bitter and resentful when others don't pick up on what I see is just so naturally and intuitively true. And keep putting it out there. You don't know who you're going to influence. You may be influencing somebody who travels through here and takes it someplace else and you don't see it. It happens to me all the time that I find I've said something that influenced somebody in another place, in another way, where I didn't see it. All the time it happens to me. Oh, we're doing this over here because of something you said. You said that one sentence, that one time. So we did this over, and I didn't even know that. That's the best I can do for you. But I agree with you completely. You know, and I know Prabhupada agrees with you. That any of our temples that have land, some temples have no land, some are right in the middle of the city, but any temple that has land should be gardening. Fruits, flowers, vegetables, and using that. As I say, I go to temples where they're growing fruits, but they're not using them. You have the fruit trees and they're going to the shop. And you're just kind of scratching your head like, how can you have a fruit tree outside when you're going to the shop? So I see either it's not being, you know, ones that are not being used, or they're being used, but they're not being used. Either they're not using the land properly at all, or they are, but they're not following up on it. They're not following through on it. So I see this all over the place. But I also see some of the other examples. You know, when I was at the Hungry Farm, I stayed in a house that had fruit trees in the yard. All of the houses have their own fruit trees. And there were two or three times when I just went outside and picked some fruit and made an offering to Giriraj, and that was my meal. You know, I mean, the lady I was staying with, she says, "Do I need to bring you prasadam?" I said, "Why? You just go to the trees right outside." So it was... And of course, they have huge storage areas where they make jam and for the winter, and they're preserving. I used to do that for many years. I had my own garden, and I used to also preserve. You know, we had tomatoes all year because I would preserve from the garden, and strawberries, I would dry the strawberries. And so I lived like that for a long time. It's a wonderful way to live. Yes, it really, and it's such a good de-stressor. You know, if your day hasn't gone the way that you would like it, you just go out in your garden. You know, and we would have stuff all winter from the garden. It was a real winter. I would put a big bag of mulch on top of the carrots, leave the carrots out all winter, and just reach under the mulch and pull a fresh carrot in the winter. And then, of course, potatoes and cabbage keep for a long time. You have this one period of time where as your stock starts to run out and your other stuff hasn't started to produce yet. But it's so satisfying. I mean, it's so satisfying to have your own peach tree. I mean, just there's nothing that compares to it. And it doesn't take a lot of work. That's just not, it's not true. It doesn't take a lot of work. And the work that it takes is enjoyable and definitely brings you very close to Krishna, and Prabhupada wanted it. There's no question that Srila Prabhupada wanted it. Absolutely clear. And even cities. This description we're reading today is of a city. It is not of a farm. It's of a city. Vedic culture does not mean only farms. If anyone tells you Vedic culture means only farms, remember this verse, 1:11-12. It doesn't. But the cities were supposed to be full of fruit trees and flowering trees, and I'm sure there were many gardens and so forth. So thank you.
Thank you.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.